Hello and welcome to the House of Comments podcast. I'm Mark Thompson. I'm a political blogger and commentator. We used to do this podcast until a few months ago. It was myself and a couple of co-hosts, Emma Burnell and Nick Dennis. But I am now doing this podcast on my own in the run-up to the general election. I've got some interesting guests lined up over the next few months. And obviously in the run-up to the general election, there's going to be a lot to talk about. So, on with the first episode. Oh, and apologies for the sound quality on my voice. My guest's voice is fine. I was using, I think, a slightly dodgy microphone, which I will improve for next week's episode.
And I'm delighted to be joined today by James Bloodworth, who is editor of Left Foot Forward and also a journalist. Hi, James.
Hi there.
Hi, thanks for joining me and Happy New Year.
Yes, Happy New Year to you.
So it was quite an interesting 2014, obviously the last year before what we knew for definite was going to be a general election, which is now this year. So what are your highlights of the year just gone?
Probably the first issue that really kind of, the first really big issue in British politics, I think, was the UKIP victory. The big shock was UKIP's victory in the European elections. I mean, I remember just over a year ago in 2013, there was a lot of worry about the rise of UKIP, but lots of commentators were saying that, well, as I said it myself at times, that, well, as we get nearer the election, this will kind of fall back just as it has done in the past, and people will return to the so-called traditional parties. But the victory in, I think, the May elections really really lit a kind of bonfire under that narrative, and I think UKIP are, for the moment at least, at least until the general election, I think their high polling is here to stay.
Obviously the Euro elections are done under a proportional system. It's actually a proportional system that a lot of proponents of reform don't particularly like. It's called the D'Hondt system, and it's quite fiddly and complicated to get your head around, and it is of course a party list system, but it is PR nonetheless, and therefore obviously people know that if they vote UKIP they're pretty likely to get UKIP, and you know UKIP already had quite a lot of MEPs. Do you still not think that there's a good strong chance that the UKIP vote will fall back as we get close to the election, and rather than polling 18, 20, 22% or whatever they are in the polls, it could easily be half or even less than that, just because first past the post is so brutal and they will be squeezed mercilessly?
I think it will fall back to some extent, but I don't think it will. I think it will still be higher than it's ever been in the past. Of course, it's not going to be the same as the Euro elections. UKIP aren't going to win the general election and form the government. But I think there's such disgust towards that people are expressed towards the main political parties. I think there will be a substantial number of people who will vote for them simply as a protest vote, even at the election, because they dislike the coalition, but also don't care very much for the Labour Party in opposition.
Yeah, I mean, it sort of feels to me a little bit like the usual rules are being suspended. I mean, what I just said about how brutal first past the post is, and you know how all parties do it, you know, in seats where they're strong or where they've got a good chance, they will say, you know, they are the only option if you want to keep Labour out, or you want to keep the Tories out, or you want to keep the Lib Dems out, or whoever it is. But it's striking me that more and more people are ignoring that and are just saying, do you know what, I don't care about that, I'm going to vote for who I want to vote for. And that's actually making the coming general election incredibly volatile and very, very difficult to call.
Yes, definitely. And I think it shows how kind of the current system has, first past the post, has really run out of road. And I'm glad that people are not being blackmailed into voting for parties they don't want to vote for simply because of the area they happen to live. I mean, I was brought up in, I'm here now actually in Somerset, and where I lived for 50 years before I was born, it was a Tory seat. It was a Tory Liberal Democrat. Liberal Democrats were the only party competing against the Tories, but I was always traditionally a Labour voter, so my only option was to vote Liberal Democrat, which I did sort of as in my opinion the far lesser of two evils.
But you pulled the Billy Bragg, did you?
Yeah, but it seems, I mean, it wasn't this was before the days of the coalition. I mean, it wasn't that bad. We had quite a left-leaning Liberal Democrat candidate, but I mean, it's profoundly undemocratic. I should be able to vote for the party I want to form the government. It seems It's, yeah, and I think I'm glad that people are kind of seeing through that now and are not being blackmailed into just voting for, you know, the lesser evil because of where they live.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, you've mentioned UKIP and the Euros, but, you know, I think perhaps as significant as that is the fact that they did manage to also win two by-elections that they themselves called effectively by having sitting Tory MPs defecting and, you know, resigning and calling the by-elections themselves. In the first case, obviously, Douglas Carswell in Clacton. And then he was returned with like a 12,000 majority. And I think you'd struggle to find any commentator or any political activist who doesn't think that Douglas Carswell is going to hold that seat at the general election. So they're certainly going to have at least one MP. And Mark Reckless resigned his seat in Rochester and Strood and called a by-election. And he won that as well, now with a much narrower majority. And I was actually there on the night as part of the BBC Radio Kent coverage, and you could tell from the reaction of everyone that they were kind of expecting, and I think maybe hoping, that it was going to be more than that. As it is, I think the Tories have got a reasonable chance of getting it back. But, you know, having two MPs now sitting, that for me seemed to change the narrative somewhat, in that I thought there was actually a reasonable chance at the general election that UKIP, even on 15 or even 18% of the vote, could still not get any MPs. And I think that's now not going to happen. They will definitely have at least one, and they could have several. Do you think that that dynamic has changed things, such as, you know, Nigel Farage, it now looks like he's going to be part of one of the leader debates, and I'm not sure that would have happened had UKIP not won at least one or two MPs.
Yes, definitely. They just look more serious having a presence in the House of Commons. They just look more like a serious outfit, which is especially important for them considering all the scandal there has been and the scandal that there was in the run up to the May elections. You know, where every day seemingly there would be an instance in the press of a UKIP candidate who'd made racist, homophobic, or sexist comments. So, like, balancing that against having relatively serious people representing you in the House of Commons, I think that does, when people go to the polls this May, I think they look a lot more credible. I mean, there is a chance that they could get more MPs, and the fact that people know that, I think, will mean people are much more willing to cast a vote for UKIP.
Yeah, I mean, do you think Farage is going to win the seat?
You would think so, because I imagine he will get lots and lots of TV coverage, especially if he is in the leader, takes part in at least one leaders debate. But at the same time, it goes back to the dynamics on the ground in the place he's standing. If a good local candidate is running against him and runs a really effective campaign, there's no guarantee he will win, however much he is on the BBC or Sky News.
Yeah. So, I mean, I feel like we are actually obviously taking a break from doing this podcast for several months now, but I did feel in the run-up to taking a break that every week we were talking about UKIP. I mean, they were certainly in the ascendancy, and I must admit I was getting a bit tired of talking about UKIP, but, I mean, it's completely unavoidable, and I think, you know, I think there's a reason why Farage was named Man of the Year or Political Man of the Year. I'm not sure I would have awarded him that role, but I can understand why he has done. What other political events of 2014 do you think stand out and will be remembered?
It's not so much one event as a phenomenon that's happened over the course of the year, and that was the disappearance of Labour's lead in the polls, or almost disappearance. It's now around kind of 1%, but we started off the year with it kind of 4 or 5%, even higher. I mean, 2 years ago I think it was around 8, 9, 10%. Just the kind of gradual disappearance of that lead. I mean, at the end of 2013, we were coming out of a very successful conference for Labour, where Labour had that bounce in the polls from the announcement of the energy price freeze. Some in the Conservative Party seemed to lose it a bit, and especially the right-wing press. There were attacks on Ed Miliband's father and just ludicrous accusations of Marxism and this campaign against the trade unions. And the Tory right kind of seemed to kind of lose it a little bit, and George Osborne himself was making these sort of accusations of Marxism as well. But this year they've been a lot more, they've upped their game quite a lot. Whereas with Labour, Labour struggled to put those policy offerings which came out in 2013, struggled to put them into this bigger narrative of how Britain would be better under a Labour government, how Labour would really change Britain rather than simply tinker around the edges and cut a little more kind of compassionately than the coalition, which isn't a particularly inspiring message. So I think I would say the kind of erosion of Labour's poll lead, and then culminating in the fears around Ed Miliband's leadership in kind of October time.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose parties, as you get closer to elections, traditionally the opposition, who might have had a stronger lead during the midterm of the parliament, generally do fall away. So, I mean, I'm not sure it was totally surprising to see, to see that happen, and to see people like Dan Hodges semi-vindicated, although he won't be fully vindicated until, you know, Ed Miliband is destroyed by fire, I think. But you know, that is the sort of thing that happens midterm. I think the thing that struck me is that, and it's something that I did think probably from earlier in the parliament as well, is that because Labour had so vocally and vociferously opposed pretty much every cut that the government had made, that it would struggle to gain credibility as we got closer to an election, and as they tried to put forward a coherent plan for what they would do about the economy. Because regardless of the fact that the Labour message earlier in the parliament probably was more nuanced, in that, you know, I think Ed Balls has always said that, you know, you need to be cautious, and, you know, the deficit does need to be reduced. But that was almost a murmur underneath the shouts and screams about the cuts and about the cost of living crisis and food banks and all of that other stuff. And so, therefore, it feels that Labour's narrative is a bit disjointed and a little bit incoherent. And however unfair it might be, given that, you know, like I say, there are probably voices on both sides within Labour, I think that the Tories are likely to, and have already to some extent, exploited that fairly mercilessly. I mean, do you think that's a fair comment?
Yes, definitely. That's one of the things I mean when I mentioned the kind of lack of a bigger narrative. It seems to have been all over the place. There's been lots of policy and there's been lots of really good policy stuff going on behind the scenes. But then they try to triangulate, but it just and please everyone, but it just ends up pleasing no one. You've seen this on lots of different areas. So on immigration, you'll get someone like Chuka Omuna who will give a speech on business and talk about bringing immigration into it and make a very pro-immigration case, sounding something like Nick Clegg, the sort of case that he would make. But then the next day you'll have a release from Rachel Reeves or a speech by Ed Miliband where he will talk as if benefit tourism is a huge problem for Britain, and then that puts off the same people who would have enjoyed Chuka Omuna's speech, the more liberal voters, then it turns them off. So you're kind of not pleasing everyone because by trying to please everyone. I think that's been a big problem in the last few years.
Yeah, and it also strikes me that there's a strange, I'm not sure if I'd use the word paradox, but kind of contradiction in that although in some areas and the way that Labour has behaved, it seemed somewhat weak and on the back foot, in some areas, it has seemed very strong and on the front foot. I mean, you yourself mentioned the Ed Miliband speech at the 2013 Labour conference where he talked about energy prices. And that went down an absolute storm, and that really struck a chord. And the polling afterwards showed that the vast majority of people in this country agreed with him and agreed that something should be done. I mean, whether or not they agreed that exactly what he was proposing should be done, and I'm not sure there was that much flesh on the bones at that point. But certainly it definitely did strike a chord. And then if you look at what happened with the vote on Syria as well, where, I mean, something happened that I think is unprecedented in the history of UK politics, which is that the leader of the opposition prevented the country from going to war. So, you know, he has been able to do some quite remarkable things. And yet, you know, you can see where we are in the polls. And if things continue in the way that you would expect in the run-up to a general election, then there's actually a fairly good chance that he won't be Prime Minister in a few months' time, despite all of that.
Yes. Going back to Syria, I think one of the problems with Ed Miliband's stance on that vote was it tended to look a little bit like politicking, like he was using the issue to win a vote in the Commons, rather than necessarily taking the point of principle. I do think he was against military intervention in Syria, but then just shortly before the vote he'd essentially told Cameron that he agreed with military action, and then voted against something he previously said he would vote for. I think that while while the public were against military intervention, I think it played into this idea of him being weak in that he was using an issue of kind of global prominence to politic in the House of Commons. So I don't take the kind of standard left wing view that it was necessarily a really popular decision. It was on the surface, but I think Cameron came out of it looking more statesmanlike, and even Nick Clegg did to some extent. I thought his speech in the Commons on that was very good. Sorry, what was the question?
Well, it was just really that at times Miliband has looked like he is actually really driving the agenda forward in a way that is unusual for a leader of the opposition, except, I mean, you know, obviously there are always exceptions, like, you know, Tony Blair in the run-up to the 1997 election. I mean, you know, I remember hearing a story about how Michael Heseltine was made to wait outside Blair's office for, like, about 2 hours until he could actually go in to see him, and he was basically begging him to allow the Millennium Dome to continue, for example. You know, and there are always exceptions to this, but given, you know, that the polls have been all over the place, it does seem that Miliband has been able on occasion to drive things forward. Whether or not it was opportunistic, you know, is maybe a slightly separate point. But he certainly has been in control at a number of times. You mentioned about the energy thing, and I was actually in the House of Commons. I was meeting my MP for some matter that was just to do with a personal matter that I'd had in the constituency he'd helped me with. And he happened to be on the Energy and Climate Change Select Committee, and it was absolute pandemonium in there. You know, they had they were supposed to have the CEOs of the big six energy companies. I think only a couple of them turned up, but then that chap from OVO Energy turned up, and, you know, it was all a big media circus. And, you know, and as I was sitting there, and he was saying, well, we've got to do this, we've got to do that, and, yeah, we've got another meeting about this, and then there's going to be... And I was just sitting there thinking, this is all happening because of Ed Miliband. This would not be happening if Ed Miliband hadn't made that speech. And it was quite remarkable just how he was really driving the agenda at that point. And that seems to have fallen away. He hasn't been able to replicate that since, really.
No, but I think there have been shadow ministers who've really owned certain areas. I think Andy Burnham has done really well on the NHS, for example, where I think Labour has quite a substantial poll lead. In contrast to the Tory lead on the economy. I think it partly comes down to, with Ed Miliband, it comes down to congruency and perceived authenticity. I don't think Ed Miliband is very good at this kind of fake authenticity that, for example, Tony Blair was very good at, and I also think David Cameron is quite good at. I think when he's on issues, when he's on territory in which he's comfortable, I think he does really very well. So when a recent speech Ed Miliband used to talk about inequality, and I think he actually really does care about that, and it comes through. Whereas when he talks about something like immigration, I don't think he really believes some of the things he's saying, and I think he can't do that kind of that fake authenticity that someone like Blair used to do, and I think people pick up on it. So when people say, I don't think he's, you know, they didn't really like a speech, but perhaps they don't know why, I think they're picking up on this lack of congruency and lack of authenticity. And so if we go back to the energy price freeze, I think he really passionately does care about something like that. And I think people sense it as well.
Yeah, I know. Obviously, he was formerly the energy secretary, wasn't he?
He really has a grasp of the brief, and he's passionate about it. So people do believe what that he actually means what he's saying.
Yeah, if we just stick with UK politics just for a little while longer, and then we'll maybe move on to more international stuff. But I did also just want to talk about the Scottish referendum, because obviously, you know, that was a major political event towards the end of last year, well, kind of middle end of last year, in September. And, I mean, what that has now led to is something that is so far from what I think anyone would have predicted, which is that, so, first of all, the referendum was lost, and therefore the union remains. Now, I think that was probably predictable, given where the polls were. But what wasn't predictable is that, far from that causing massive consternation within the SNP and causing them to dip in the polls and the union parties to benefit from that, the precise opposite has happened. And what we've seen is that the SNP are flying really high in the polls. Some polls are suggesting that they might win, you know, the vast majority of seats at Westminster in Scotland, and could leave Labour with only a few MPs, a handful maybe. And I think probably that's unlikely, but I mean, who knows? It's kind of through the looking glass scenario that we're in now. I mean, what are your thoughts about that? Were you involved in the campaign at all?
I wasn't. We ran quite a few Better Together pro Better Together campaign articles on Left Foot Forward, but I wasn't really like deeply involved with the campaign myself. In terms of Labour's position in Scotland now, I don't think it's too unlike that of the Liberal Democrats in the rest of the country, in that now Labour are Scottish people I've heard repeatedly say that, you know, Labour, you worked with the Tories for the Better Together campaign, so we'll never vote for you again, in the same way that you have, you know, some like left-wing Liberal Democrat voters in the rest of the country will say we'll never vote for the Liberal Democrats again because they've gone into coalition with the Conservatives. I think you're seeing that effect to some extent. And also, you've got this, again, the anti-Westminster vote that's propelling UKIP in England. That vote's going to the SNP in Scotland. I don't think in some respects it's that dissimilar. You have a generation of Westminster politicians who, in my opinion, are very uninspiring, very uncharismatic, and there is no really big vision, especially on the social democratic left in England. We could win power. The Labour Party could win power, and most people don't really know what they would do with it. And I think that's a huge problem. So these votes are kind of bleeding away to parties in Scotland like the SNP, and in England towards UKIP.
Yeah, I mean, maybe we'll come back to the potential ramifications of that in a few minutes, in terms of how that could affect the post general election landscape. But just briefly, you wanted to also talk about Russia's annexation of Crimea as one of the most significant events of last year too.
Yes, I just wanted to mention it in that I think it's to use the cliche, it's a real game changer in terms of European geopolitics. I mean, Putin was grudgingly seen for ever since, like, when he came to power in 2000, that we could work with him, and grudgingly he would work with us. And I think, first of all, Syria, his continued support for Assad in Syria, but then the blazing annexation of Crimea. And then you regularly see news reports now of him sending fighter jets to kind of intimidate the Baltic countries. There was almost an incident recently where a Swedish passenger plane almost collided with a Russian fighter plane. I think the game has really changed in Europe now, and the cliche of it being a kind of new Cold War, I think, really does hold true. And I don't think politicians have really quite realised that yet.
Yeah, and that's quite frightening for people of my generation, or maybe slightly earlier. I mean, I've just turned 40 last year, so I do actually remember what it was like to be in the mid 80s, and when the Cold War, and I remember watching a horrendous television program called Threads. They actually made us watch it in school.
Yes.
It was all about
yes.
the aftermath of the nuclear war in Sheffield, and it was absolutely horrific. And and at the time, I mean, you can watch that. I watched it a few years ago and it was still horrific, but it was sort of tinged with a bit of, well, that was the Cold War. Things are better now. The idea that we're backsliding into a situation similar to that again, that unpredictable, and you've got someone like Putin at the helm who, is incredibly unpredictable. And what's happened with the oil price in the last few weeks, the last couple of months as well. I'm not sure geopolitically what's driving that. But it's looking like the oil price is going to stay low for a while. And that's great for me down at the pumps when I'm filling my car up. But at the same time, that is absolutely crucifying the Russian economy. And, there's a question mark over whether, Putin will be ousted as a result of that, or whether he will be strengthened because he'll be able to rally his country against the people outside his country who are trying to perhaps, drive the economy into the ground. It's a very, very volatile situation and very scary.
Yes, and I think the weakness and division in Europe now in the European Union is really aiding Putin's agenda. I mean, if we look at the rise of the far right in France, for example, the Front National, God forbid they win the next French election, but they're very pro-Putin. You see the Syriza party on the far left in Greece, also very opposed to any sanctions on Russia. You see this kind of the more extreme parties. In Europe, of the left and the right, they take a very kind of conciliatory line with Putin's Russia, and he's kind of there's strong evidence that he's been giving money to the Front National, for example. If you watch Russia Today, you'll see lots of kind of cranks from the far left and far right on that television station. He's got this really real agenda to kind of weaken Europe now and aid parties which want to split up the European project. And you can see why, because a weak Europe means he can make further territorial gains in places like Ukraine without opposition. I mean, one of the reasons he's invaded Ukraine rather than the Baltic states is very simply because the Baltic states are in NATO. The reason somewhere like Ukraine wants to join the European Union, wants to join NATO, is because it's afraid of Russia. It's essentially why Poland wanted, for example, a few years ago to have missiles, US missiles, on its territory. I don't think we quite realise in this country what it's like to live in one of those countries where there's a constant threat, essentially of Russian invasion, and where you've had Russian occupation for half of the previous century.
Yeah. Yeah, scary times. In terms of predicting what, or talking about what may happen this coming year, because I just wanted to move on to that finally, but just sticking with Russia, do you think Putin will still be in power in 12 months' time?
I think so. From the stuff I've read, the oil price is likely to stay low, but they've kind of prepared for this situation. And living standards have risen a lot since Putin came to power. So commentators in the know are saying that he has about 2 years to kind of turn things around.
You're saying he's sort of got quite a lot of political capital still to spend.
Yes, I don't think necessarily it will provoke him into starting new wars, although that is a possibility. I think he has got a certain amount of political capital because living standards have risen really, really a lot since he first came to office. The danger is, though, that if Putin is ousted in some kind of coup, that what's behind him is also even worse. He's kind of built his power on this kind of, it's become almost a mafia state, but a lot of the people behind him are even more ideologically opposed to the West. It's far right nationalism, essentially Christian nationalism, but it's much more extreme than him. So I'm not particularly optimistic at the moment.
Yeah, a certain element of be careful what you wish for, because the devil you know, maybe a little bit. Although you know, I would hope if he was ousted, he'd be replaced by someone better. But then why would he be?
Yeah, I mean, there's the fall in the oil price. There is a kind of plus side for it beyond consumers in the West getting cheaper fuel, in that lots of the nastiest regimes in the world are being really undermined by the drop in the oil price. So you've got Iran, you've got Venezuela, you've got Russia, and while Saudi Arabia is at the moment kind of helping to drive the fall in prices to undermine its competitor in Iran, it will impact on Saudi Arabia as well eventually. And lots of this goes back to the rise in shale production in the US, for example. But there is a plus side in that it's undermining some of these regimes. But again, instability doesn't always lead to a better outcome in a dictatorship. It can lead to something far worse, as you know, we see in the Middle East now with ISIS.
Indeed. Okay, so just moving back to domestic politics then and for the coming year. I mean, obviously, we talked about the rise of UKIP, and we've talked about Labour's the fall in Labour's lead, and also the aftermath of the referendum, the Scottish referendum. I mean, how do you think all of those things and all the other stuff that happened last year will play out in the coming general election? I mean, first of all, I almost hesitate to ask this, given how volatile everything is, but what do you think the result of the election is going to be?
At the moment, if the election was held today, I would say it would be a coalition, a hung parliament, and then a coalition of some sort afterwards. I wouldn't like to predict what the coalition would be, because I think that could really go any way at the moment. It depends on a party, for example, like the SNP. If they win a lot of seats, I think they'd be far more willing to go into a coalition with Labour. I don't think they would go into coalition with the Conservatives. But then you might end up with a situation where you have a Labour government propped up by the SNP where nothing really gets done. So alternatively, you could have the Conservatives going in again with the Lib Dems. I think that's very feasible with a weakened Lib Dem party if Clegg stayed. But I think for that, Clegg would have to stay. I don't think if Clegg was replaced by someone like Tim Farron or Vince Cable, I suppose, would be the caretaker option. I can't foresee them going in again with the Conservatives. But I would say at the moment, hung parliament. I think Labour could edge it if some of the scandals coming out of the NHS get worse. I mean, I've seen the Daily Mail's been reporting on that quite a lot, which when they start to get annoyed about something like that, you know, it's kind of starting to break through into these concerns are starting to break through into Middle England. It's not just kind of a left wing concern. If this keeps rumbling on, I think that will play very very much in Labour's favour. So I think I still think there's a chance of Labour getting a minority government.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned about the Lib Dems there. I know. I mean, I used to be a Lib Dem. I quit the party in 2013, but I still, you know, I'm in touch with quite a lot of members, and I know that a lot of Lib Dems, although they weren't willing to throw Clegg overboard, you know, last year and after the disaster of the Euro elections and the local elections, in the end they decided to stick with him just because it would be worse to get rid of him. But the idea that after the general election, if Lib Dems have lost, say, half of their MPs and, you know, are generally by the electorate, you know, seem to have been given a massive kick, the idea that Clegg will just stay and just go back in with the Tories and everything will be just as was before, I think there are a lot of Lib Dem members who would be apoplectic with rage if that happened. And I wouldn't like to predict what would internally happen within the party were that to happen. I mean, there's no easy mechanism for getting rid of Clegg, but, you know, I think it requires 75 local parties, or at least it doesn't with the current number of MPs. I'm not sure what would happen post-election. But I think that could be very, very interesting. And I think there's almost a moral argument that the Lib Dems could actually say, you know what, we've lost half or more of our votes, we've lost so many MPs, we're not going to go into coalition, we don't think that's what the country wants, and take a step back. And I almost wonder if it might be better for the party to do that and lick its wounds and try and renew itself out of office rather than try and carry on either with the Tories or Labour. I think you know that there's quite a strong argument for that. Having said that, if Clegg does remain in place, I'm sure he will want to go back into government. He's made that a founding principle of his leadership, that, you know, he wants to be in power. So if there's a chance of it, I'm sure he'll grab it.
Yes, I think it would be. I think there is a significant chance that if Clegg was deposed, then let's speculate someone like Tim Farron with that politics. I think there is quite a high chance they would be willing to go into government with Labour. Whether that would be a good idea for Labour or the Lib Dems remains to be seen. But it would seem to be. I mean, that would be a way to almost detoxify the brand to some extent, to be in a centre-left government after being in kind of a centre-right government.
Yes, but the counter-argument...
Depends what happens,
that,
of course. But...
Exactly, but the counter-argument to that looks like they just look like completely, you know, politically unprincipled gadflies who'll go in with anyone. And I'm sure that's exactly what the Tories would then say, you know, that they'll get into bed with anyone and they don't care and they have no principles.
And they'd also be expected in government, in a Labour government, to trash the previous kind of 5 years, which would upset people who'd been in that government. And
yeah,
it would just seem, again, incongruent, like no one would believe them. Yeah, I do see where you're coming from there.
Yeah. I think, but actually, I mean, I've written about this and I've talked about this. I think the Lib Dems are basically screwed whatever they do. I think the only thing that they can do that would give them any real chance of renewing and, you know, in the longer term, perhaps rebuilding, is to go into opposition. If they end up back in government, either with the Tories or with Labour, I think they are pretty much finished as a political force after 2020. But that's probably an entire podcast for another day. Are there any other predictions that you want to make for the coming year, maybe outside of the general election?
A few international predictions, maybe. Well, first, I do think sticking to domestic politics first, I do think Nigel Farage will win his seat. I do think UKIP will continue to grow. I think there is a ceiling. There'll come a point when they'll hit a ceiling. Again, as I mentioned earlier, I don't think we have the most inspiring generation of political leaders. I think it's worse than just the leaders themselves. I think behind them, there aren't, in the Labour Party, in the Conservative Party. I think the Lib Dems fare a little bit better in this respect. But I don't think there are particularly inspiring candidates ready to kind of come to the fore in the next few years. And I think that really aids the rise of UKIP. Internationally, I think there'll be... Again, I think you'll see more aggression from Russia, but in Ukraine rather than him invading any new countries. I think the oil price will stay low. I think you'll see the collapse of the economy in Venezuela. I think you'll see a closer relationship between the US and Iran. I think Syria will continue to be completely horrific. And I think more encouragingly, I think the Kurdish forces will start to push ISIS back a bit more, which they seem to have been doing recently, which is the best news I've heard over Christmas, in fact. Apart from that, no, that's kind of about it.
Okay, well,
hope to see a Labour government this year.
Yeah, to be honest, I'm not sure what I want to see now. like I say, I was a Lib Dem, and I'm still sort of a fellow traveller with, you know, their principles. And but, you know, there's so much that I wanted to see happen that just hasn't happened with this government, and I think I'm starting to realise really can never happen, or at least, you know, not in any reasonable time frame, because the Lib Dems can only drive so much forward. They only have, you know, and they'll probably have far fewer seats in any future government. So I'm really not sure what way I want things to go. But at least what you said there about ISIS being driven back is perhaps an optimistic note on which to end the podcast for this week. So thank you very much for your time, James.
No problem. Nice to speak to you.
And you.
So that's the end of the first episode of this rebooted House of Commons podcast. I will be back next week with another guest discussing the previous week's politics. I'd just like to thank Audio Boom. They've now added an M to the end of their name, I have to remember that, for hosting the podcast. And to Kevin McLeod at incomputech.com for our theme music.